Hi, I'm Bunny Guinness, and this is my podcast, Bunny in the Garden, with someone special. Someone who is well known for something other than their green fingers, but who is also a mustard-keen gardener. I'll discover them through their garden, why, how, and when they garden, the best tips they've learnt, and their gardening style and approach. I'm pleased to be in the garden today with Caroline Haughey, OBE, KC. Caroline is a criminal barrister specialising in prosecuting modern slavery and trafficking cases. She prosecuted the first modern slavery case in the UK and also helped draft the Modern Slavery Act in 2015. Caroline advises other countries on legislation and effective prosecution of human trafficking and exploitation cases. She also helps on TV dramas and authors such as Mark Billingham. Caroline, you wanted to become a criminal barrister from the age of 8. Tell me about it. That's very young to know what you want to do. So many people would be so envious.
It's a bit tragic, really. And it's funny you say that, Bunny. When I talk to kids now and young people about their job aspirations, the one thing I say to them is, don't shut your mind off to anything. The reason I wanted to do it, I remember the case so vividly, was watching a case unfold on the news about a girl who went missing. And they found her body, and then there was the criminal trial. And I was fascinated by the process. I was fascinated about everyone having a voice, everyone having the right to representation. And just why do people do what they do fascinates me. I don't think I'm a conventional criminal barrister or a lawyer for that matter, because it's who's done what, who's the victim, how do we investigate it, how do we prosecute it, how do we defend it. I'm as much interested in why, and I think that's one of the reasons I ended up doing modern slavery and human trafficking, as it happens. But I'm doing what I always wanted to do, and I'm very privileged to be able to say that.
That's extraordinary. I do think it is so difficult nowadays to find out what you want to do, because you don't really understand at school what it's about, what jobs are like, do you? You do a very narrow range of subjects. And when you find what you love doing and you master it, it is just the best thing in life, I think. Better than anything.
I couldn't agree more. I mean, it sounds awful. I read crime novels. I read criminal textbooks for fun. That's truly nerdy. But I don't think of my job as employment. I think of it as being kind of a defining part of who I am, because it imbues me with joy. And that sounds like a horrible thing to talk about other people's misery as giving you joy. But the joy for me is being able to speak for those who can't speak, to be able to make sure the processes and the rules, which I profoundly believe in, are properly applied and that we have fairness.
Yeah. You are a self-confessed crime junkie. And you said that Sky Plus is the best invention ever for my guaranteed fix. And iPlayer got me through waiting many a jury verdict. But I thought, I mean, my son's a medic and he used to watch medical dramas. And then since he's become one, oh my God, he says, I could not watch them. They are so far from reality. But you obviously advise on criminal dramas and things like that, and you must have a view on them, and you still find them fascinating, even though you must watch some of them and think that is absolute tosh. Lincoln Lawyer, for advantage. Do you ever watch Lincoln Lawyer?
Yes, but not consistently.
Which means you don't think it's great in terms
of actuality. I think the drama is great. I love drama.
Yeah.
But I do recognise that there is a need for sometimes the banality and mundanity of criminal process to be suppressed in order to keep the audience engaged. But still makes me cross.
Yeah, but I mean, from that, I always wonder when I watch that, and I know nothing about law, that it seems to me that all the lawyers do all the investigation work and the police do nothing. How much of your work is actually investigative and helping the police, and how much is it just legal proceedings?
I think I'm an unusual lawyer in the respect that much of my work is actually advising the police and on investigation. Because I have such a small specialism in modern slavery, quite often I'm brought in at the very, very beginning of investigations.
So the police will come to you and say, we've got this guy we think is trafficking people and using them as slaves. What should we do?
Exactly that. So my current case, I've got five or six on the run at the moment, but one of them is a large sex trafficking case the investigation's been running since 2017. I was instructed.
2017?
Mm. And I was instructed in 2021. And my police officer and case lawyer said, you know, we know what we've got, but we don't know how to make it right for court. Where do we go? What do we do? And so I can turn around to them and go, right, these are the things we need to put in order. This is the sort of evidence I'm looking for. Can you get this? And this is a case where we're only likely to have one victim giving an account in court, although we know that there's 750 victims. So we are really moving towards understanding what evidence we can use. Where do we get it from? How do we demonstrate to the jury how the case or how this criminal organisation worked?
I see. And so is it different, though, in the States that they do more, the barristers do more of the investigative work than
the
UK?
Yeah, it's a different process. So the great thing about the criminal justice process in the UK, in England and Wales, Northern Ireland, and slightly separately in Scotland, is that we are independent. So I prosecute and defend. Mm. So as well as I do my modern slavery trafficking work, I'm defending on a trafficking case, I'm defending on a couple of murders and all the rest of it. In America, you are either a prosecutor or you're, you know, a defense attorney.
Yeah.
And also, we don't have that distinction in the States between counsel, barristers, and solicitors. And they're much more, I would argue, rounded in their approach, in the sense that they will do everything, and particularly the DA's office works in synchronicity with the police in a very different way than we do here. So in the UK or in England, Wales, we'll have the police will instruct, will ask the CPS to do a case. The CPS will then instruct counsel. In the US, the DA and the police will be working hand in hand pretty much from the get-go, and the DA will take the case, the district attorney will take the case to the court.
Right.
So different process. But what makes me laugh is I often watch these crime dramas, and I love them. But some of the stuff that's happened in my courtroom has been way more bizarre and unusual. I mean, I had I was prosecuting a sex trafficking case a long time ago, and there was a corrupt police community support officer who was blackmailing prostitutes, amongst other things, in the case. And I was opening the case to the jury, and I was playing the recording of the police officer blackmailing the sex workers. His mother was in the public gallery, and as I played the video, it ran for about 2.5 minutes. 30 seconds in, she stood up, clutched her chest, and dropped down of a heart attack. So I had to send the jury out, and the judge, and my officer, and I had to get down and start recess. I mean, you know.
My God. So really, you should be writing this up. So are we going to have a lovely thing? Like, who is that lovely, the old crime barrister, the old guy?
Oh, Rumpel of the Bailey.
Rumpel. Are we going to have a modern version of Rumpel?
I'm not Please. As funny as John Mortimer, nor am I as articulate or as intelligent. I think I'll delegate that to someone else. Maybe when, you know, I have my brief retirement from court proceedings, they'll take me out of court in a coffin, probably.
I think you would be hilarious. I'm sure you would be hilarious. But you're also someone with, as you put it, a slightly neurotic interest in forensic. And you have great pleasure in having canine DNA tested. Now, we are surrounded by hundreds of your dogs here. You also are a Jack Russell fan. I love you. I love them. And he's lying beside you with his typical Jack Russell pose, sort of legs splayed on his back, tongue hanging out, and enjoying having his tummy scratched.
I think it's fair to say Gerald is living his best life.
Yes, dog's life, Gerald, poor you. And so you've had your Jack Russells tested.
So we didn't test our Jack Russells, but I did a really bizarre case in Croydon years ago. Crikey, this must be 15 or 18 years ago. And it was all to do with whether they found DNA. And this was back in the days when DNA was fresh, but not not as developed as it is now. We did have a DNA database, but not known to the same extent, and we were still using low copy number and that kind of thing then, rather than fast track DNA.
Right.
And DNA was found in an address where there was an alleged burglary. We knew that it wasn't human. We knew that it was canine. And my client had an alibi. I remember saying to the judge, and I said, we should just test to make sure what breed of dog it is, because my client breeds Staffordshire Bull Mastiffs, and they'll be able to say if it's Staffy DNA or not, because the homeowner also had DNA, and another person, canine in the house, and another person who was a potential suspect had dogs as well. So I wanted to be able to exclude my client. So sent it off to America for testing, and it came back as not Staffy.
Right. So your client was okay.
Yeah.
Oh, well done. And also you say that many clients you would kill, many scientists would kill for the facilities of the US labs.
Oh my gosh, yeah.
And many of your clients live in fear of them. So we are way behind in DNA testing.
I would have said we were way behind in DNA testing. I think I've been very privileged to see my practice evolve with the evolution of technical investigation.
Yes.
Mobile phone handset downloads, DNA, ear prints, not Whoa. Just fingerprints. So ear prints Weird. Are unique. Yeah.
On your phone?
No, ear prints on windows for burglaries.
Oh.
Why else?
Would you... Oh, you're listening to see who's yeah. in there.
Fingerprints have come on immeasurably. We don't really use fingerprints anymore. I was very privileged to be led by an amazing woman who's now a judge called Alison Hunter. And we did the Southwark rapist, a man called Michael Roberts. And we were a case that explored low copy number DNA, which was the replication of
small by low copy number. Sorry to be thick. What does that mean? It's just low resolution. You haven't got the whole thing out.
Exactly that. And yes. It got spun out in the labs by an amazing scientist called Dr. Whitaker, Jonathan Whitaker, and he was the one who developed all of this. And we were able to demonstrate, even though these were rapes that happened in the early 90s. Over a very long period of time, we were able to use the very small, tiny amounts of DNA, and he was able to spin them out from low copy number to give us appropriate amounts to identify that it was Michael Roberts was a predatory serial rapist.
Wow, that's good, isn't it?
And yeah. So I find that fascinating. Things have improved dramatically. I wouldn't say we're as advanced as the USA in crime analysis, and we have a different regime. We can't use phone intercept as evidence, whereas in the States, that's perfectly acceptable. Frankly, around most of Europe, it's perfectly acceptable.
I thought you could if you got special consent.
So what you can use it is something under the Regulation of Investigatory Powers Act. You can obtain permission to listen in on a phone to assist in an investigation. But the contents of that cannot be used as evidence in court.
That does seem a bit bizarre.
Well, particularly when the rest of Europe yeah. can use it. And more importantly, if it's obtained in Europe without us asking for it, but we obtain it afterwards, we can use that, which I've done in a Hungarian case. So it's...
Are you going to change that?
You know what? We talk about Britain being a very over-regulated society. Now, when I look at where we are in comparison to the rest of Europe, I think we're a really liberal society. Do I think we need to use it? I'm not sure we do when we capture so much on telephones these days with people's messaging. I mean, I lecture to young people coming up through life, and the advice to them is always the same. Do not put anything in an email or a message that you wouldn't show your granny or be happy to show a judge in court. And it's amazing how many of them kind of look at their phones and go, woo, okay, let me go for a little cleanup operation. And I say it to my daughters repeatedly, you know, I need your PIN codes. I need to be able to lift your phone up at any time and look at it, and you should not be ashamed.
Mm.
And I think if you start with that as your line in the sand, it makes people think. I was really lucky. I grew up with, there's not many humiliating photographs of me. Definitely some, but not as many as there could be.
So we're here in your garden. I probably first met you in your garden about 10, 11 years ago.
Yeah,
when
10 years
ago. You
just
bought it, hadn't you? Is that
yes.
right?
Yes, we bought the house 12 years ago, and we discovered you because I have been following you on Gardener's Quest in time, which is ironic because you know I have a phobia of touching soil.
Yes.
But my Sunday morning treat is Gardener's Quest in time.
Oh.
And I discovered that you lived locally. And so I stalked you online. My husband, who, as you know, has an amazing vision for things that are creative, and we roped you into coming and helping us try and galvanise the garden.
I have to say, I am so impressed with all that you've done here. I cannot believe it. And Mark is fascinating, your husband, isn't he? Because
yeah.
I remember meeting you and thinking, gosh, two barristers married to each other. You know, arguing must be interesting.
You know, it's funny you say that. We don't argue very much. I mean, we have heated discussions. We're very politically aligned. He is extraordinarily clever and well-read, but hides it very lightly. And he's a huge people person as well.
Yes.
But we are a great believer in sitting at the table and eating together as a family. You know,
and having really useful discussions
yeah.
and things, as you did as a child, didn't you? Because
yes.
you're, I always remember when you mentioned it, I met your mother here, yeah. and she was huge in festers, and she used to be a solicitor.
Yes.
And you said of your childhood, you'd all sit round the table, you'd have very free, frank and open discussions.
Yeah.
And that's probably what, that's what gave you your whole, well, you're a fantastic communicator, and I imagine all your family are. Your brother...
Yeah, I've got two younger brothers who are both very articulate, very, yeah. very bright. And we've grown, we were really privileged. We grew up in a really interesting, enlightened environment in Northern Ireland. We're from a mixed marriage.
Yes.
Which then...
By mixed, you mean obviously Roman Catholic, Catholic Protestant. Yeah.
Yes. Or Presbyterian.
Yeah.
And my parents were great believers in, if you hold an opinion, you are absolutely entitled to that opinion, but you must be accountable for it. You must be able to justify it. And they were great believers in looking, thinking and remaining curious, and agreeing to disagree. And I think that's maybe something that's a little missing now. And I think it's something that we really encourage in the children. Our children are really different. Mm. You know, if I've got one child who is obsessed with sport, and then I've got another child who's obsessed with music, and then my two young ones just are different and deep thinkers. And we all celebrate being different and agreeing to disagree. But for me, the most important thing is remaining curious, because you never know what you're going to learn.
Mm. That's fascinating. And then because of that, as education is so segregated in Ireland, isn't it? They decided to send you to a school in England.
Yes.
So you could make your own decision.
Yeah.
Which I think is amazing. So were they were always throughout their life, both different religions. They
Mummy, didn't. Well, Mummy is still a practicing Presbyterian.
Yeah.
And funnily enough, my brother got married a couple of years ago in Rome by a Presbyterian minister with the basilica in the background, which I think reflects our family. And my father was, I would call, a lapsed practicing Catholic. I think he described himself as a buttress to the church. He liked to support it from outside.
right.
But we had family members who were in, you know, nuns and involved in the priesthood. And my parents were very... And we were always taught about people are different, and that's okay. You know, my father and mother absolutely loved the power of the words of someone like Martin Luther King. That fascinated them, and the power of oration, and the power of breaking bread together. So going back to eating at the table together and discussing.
Yeah, interesting. And then when you made your application to be a QC, diversity was an important... A very important part of that. Now, just to explain to any listeners in America who don't understand QC and KC. So you were one of the youngest ever to become QC. And then you were the first person to have a trial where you were the first KC when the king became king.
Yes.
Just explain exactly what a KC, QC is.
So Queen's Counsel, as it then was, King's Counsel, is you make the application at some point in your practice if you want to. It's not a cheap experience.
Having been a barrister.
Having been a barrister or a solicitor.
Or a solicitor, yes.
And it's a mark of quality. It is the ultimate barrister, solicitor, lawyer quality control mark.
Yes.
You apply and you go through this process explaining why you deserve these letters after your name. And you have to demonstrate different traits, advocacy, written advocacy, diversity, understanding, giving to the profession, all of those kind of things. And it's a 65-page application. It's not an easy process.
And you can't just cut and paste it.
You definitely can't cut and paste it. And you have to have referees who are members of the judiciary and fellow barristers. So you've got to be front-footed all the time, knowing that this is what you're thinking of doing.
Mm.
And if you pass the first assessment, that's the kind of application assessment, you then go for an interview. And one of the questions I was asked in an interview, and I loved my interview, bizarrely, was... What did I think being a woman would bring to the profession? And being, if I was to be made Queen's Counsel, as it then was, because it's named after the monarch, because of course, when we bring cases in the criminal courts, we bring them on behalf of the monarch. So it used to be Regina versus, now it's Rex. And I remember saying to my panel, who I enjoyed being interviewed by enormously, if this is being given to me because I happen to be of the right sex, I don't want this. I want this because I am good enough. And because I'm doing the right thing and because I'm leading by example. You know, I believe in meritocracy, absolutely. And I believe in what justice is, which is gender blind, color blind, race blind, faith blind. Lady Justice is blindfolded. Mm. And that's how we should all strive to succeed. So then you have your interview, which, as I say, I really enjoyed mine. And then I got the appointment on my birthday. I was sitting at home with my mum.
At what age?
I was 42.
That is young. That is amazingly exceptional.
Well, it was really funny. I was on the phone dealing with children in Northern Ireland, and my mum was there, and my husband came in, and I said, there's an email, can you open it, whilst I was on the phone. And he opened it, and he came in, and he went, you're a cutie. And I was like, really? And I was like, I hadn't expected it. Mm. This was almost a trial run, but I was very privileged. I had amazing mentors. One female, very senior judge, a male High Court judge who's been a very, very dear friend, a Silk who led me, and then two of my juniors were like, you've got to apply now, you're doing ridiculous things, you've got, this is your time. So I did, and I didn't expect to succeed, but here I am. And then obviously last year, or the year before rather, Her Majesty passed away, and it was on a Thursday, and on the Friday morning, I think I've got the days right, I was listed at 9:45 in Staffordshire Crown Court on a trafficking case. I do other work, just to be clear. And the judge called me on, and we were on the link, so the video link, which we now use quite a lot of since COVID. And she said, good morning. And we were all very somber, because it was one of those monumental moments. We knew things had changed.
Mm.
And
because the Queen had died.
Yeah. And there's a tradition of wearing weepers, so special outfits on your silk gown, and I had ordered weepers and they'd arrived because we knew that she wasn't well. And
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Didn't know about weepers.
And when we go online, so I could be sitting in my office, I am fully robed up, wig and gown, the whole works, which when you have people walking past your window, they look in and they think, okay, strange. it looks like some sort of cosplay in a strange way. But our judge called us on and said, Miss Hockey, King's Counsel, I understand you appear on behalf of His Majesty. I was like, I do, Your Honour. And she said, I believe that we are the first court listing to be called on in England and Wales, and therefore you are the first of Her Majesty's King's Counsel. And
amazing.
I just remember thinking it was having a moment and actually shedding a tear for what had been and what we now have.
Yeah.
And because when we swear our allegiance to His or Her Majesty, it's a massive responsibility. You don't just have to talk the talk, you actually have to stand up for this. And it's a privilege to have this job.
Yeah.
And that really marked the privilege for me, I think.
Now, your dog is sitting on my knee and you're distracting me, smiling at me, wagging his tail.
I can only apologise. Gerald will shower you with love.
Gerald, darling,
I
love you, but I'm just... Yeah, so it's interesting, this thing about diversity, because you said because you went to a private school, people judged it against you because you went to a private school, but then you were also judged again because you had an Irish accent.
Yeah, I know, you couldn't win. So I remember starting at my first prep school, which wasn't a success, and my parents had the wherewithal to take me out. And then I went to this amazing, bucolic, gorgeous little prep school in Kent called Sibden Park. And it was run by a lady called Marza, who had retired, and her daughter and son-in-law, Hugh and Barbara Service, ran it. And I know that some prep schools have had dreadful feedback recently. This was heaven.
Mm.
And it had the most exquisite gardens, and I think between my parents who love their gardens and this amazing rose garden at Sibden where I was allowed to go and sit and read, I think that really imbued my love of roses in particular. But when I started there, my Northern Irish accent was pretty strong, and so they made me speak in French so they could work out what I was actually saying. And then I went on to Wickham Abbey, and it was an excellent academic institution. I made some extraordinarily amazing friends, and I had some superb teachers. I'm not necessarily sure the headmistress and I were a natural bond, if I could put it that way.
You are a rebel. Were you a rebel?
No, I was a complete opposite. I'm a complete A-grade nerd, number one. But number two, I just think I was not what she was looking for. I wouldn't describe myself as refined. I wouldn't describe myself as polished. I'm pretty direct. And I talk a lot. Mm. I'm not sure that's necessarily what they were looking for. I mean, it was amazing. I had some phenomenal teachers who I'm still very close to, who really nurtured me, and I'm very privileged to have that. But I wouldn't necessarily say she in particular encouraged me, but it worked. By telling me I wasn't going to succeed, the rejection became my rocket fuel and my driver. So, you know, it's always swings and roundabouts.
Yeah. So you might not have been Wickham Abbey's sort of ideal, but I think that most of the world, you probably hit a lot of gold stars in many points.
Well,
including your communication skills, your enthusiasm, your directness, and also your tenacity. And
yeah,
also,
I'm a Jack Russell.
You're a Jack Russell, a hybrid. Would you say whereby that, or Jack Russells are tenacious when they go down holes? You mean?
Yeah, I think. I think I'm mainly
as
Jack
opposed
Russell.
To a Labrador, which lies on its back and smiles.
Yeah,
at everyone.
You haven't met our cocker spaniels, Bunny. Troy, our rescue cocker spaniel. I think I'm quite like him. I mean, his nickname's Cheesecake because that's his favourite food. I am definitely Jack Russell, but I'm also very soft and I care very deeply about people. That's the privilege of our job. Whether you're prosecuting or defending, we have to be the voice for those who can't speak, whether it's the dead, whether it's the deprived, whether it's the damaged. Whatever it is our responsibility to ensure that the process is fair and that their voice is heard. And to be afforded that as your calling is a truly amazing thing to have.
Yeah, I agree. You mentioned briefly about your parents' love of gardens there, but so when they sent you to private school, they were not hugely wealthy at that point. So it was, you know, they did it and really had to give up a few things in order to do that. But subsequent to that, obviously your father was a huge hit as a businessman, extraordinarily successful, very clever man, hard-working. And he had this sort of pension for buying up properties and doing them. He obviously loved doing that, which your brother seems to have inherited, and you and your husband seem to do.
Mum and Dad renovated Bally Edmund Castle and Corby Castle in Cumbria and our first house in Northern Ireland. My mother's knowledge of flowers, trees, I mean, this is the woman who, when we go around and look around gardens, will literally give me the Latin name, the root, tell me everything about it. And I feel like such a fraud because I can go, ah, look at that Jasmine Leonis and think that I'm quite smart. And then Mum will go, ah, yes, but did you know? And then take me through the entire flower bed. And for my parents, when they renovated Bally Edmund, they had such incredible vision and they were really a dynamic duo.
Yes.
You know, if Dad was energy, vision and get up and go, Mum was make it happen. And one couldn't function without the other.
Really?
Oh, yeah, they were extraordinary. I mean, Mum, if Dad's business success was very much put down to Dad, Mum was the engine parts behind that to make it work. A really interesting couple. And, you know, she was remarkable. She ran her own law firm in Northern Ireland, her own practice. She was one of the leading experts in trust and conveyancing law, a subject I didn't succeed in ever. And we don't talk about that. But they made a real point. They used Crosby Cochrane, someone else who used to do Gardener's Question Time a long time ago, a Northern Irish gardener who helped them restore the historical gardens. And my mother's passion, Dad was trees, Mum was all plants, and they cultivated and they grew and they invested from the very beginning of renovating the house so that the garden and the house grew together.
And did you grow up in that? Where did you grow up?
We grew up in the same village but didn't move to Bally Edmund until I was about 16.
And what was that like? So he had finished this big renovation at that point.
Yeah.
And you moved into this extraordinarily stunning place with
it's
a
beautiful.
Massive orangery.
But we grew up with it. We didn't know any different. But we were made to deadhead the roses and go and pick the fruit and veg. And it's a nearly self-sufficient fruit and veg garden. It's remarkable. And it's ever-evolving.
Yeah.
Mum's put in a dry garden now. And it's... we gave her, for her one of her birthdays, 4 eucalyptus trees. And, you know, knowing what to buy my mother for Christmas or birthday is pretty easy. As long as it's garden-driven, we're happy bunnies. It's wonderful, and she's passed on that love to my 2 younger children in particular.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I mean, they're very happy. I mean, my roses are deadheaded here. I haven't tackled the other side of the house yet, but they're very happy to help me do that. And we're repotting some sunflowers and nasturtiums tomorrow. And, you know, they, my husband grows his own chilies. And although we haven't done what I'd love to have done that my parents did, we've brought this garden on. And it's, well, you know as well as I do, Bunny, there, it's not like a house. You build a house and you've redecorated it and you can live with that. But a garden is
slowly evolving.
Yeah. And it's, you plant something now for your children's children to enjoy.
Yes.
Yeah. And we've been very privileged. This house has some beautiful trees. And very sadly, we lost a 500-year-old oak tree. It got a fungal infection and crashed down. And what was really spectacular was taking the children up and being able to show them the points in history that it reflected.
Mm.
And, you know, we planted an avenue of trees over one side. And where they were 5 years ago and where they are now, that's all really special. And we planted, my father loved magnolias. And when he passed away, we planted five magnolias, a magnolia Rothschild, a stellata, and I can't remember the others. Mm. And they all flower at different times.
You know, so you like, think of him?
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, coming to flower.
And my mother-in-law is a very, very keen gardener. And so she's given us beautiful asos. And we've got, when I was at Wickham Abbey, we had the most stunning red beech tree outside the chapel. And I loved our chapel. And for my 40th birthday, she gave me a copper beech to plant.
Mm.
And, you know, she's has been as, it's really... We're really privileged, the relationship we have with our parents. I'm very close to my mother-in-law, my husband's very close to my mother. What they've gifted us is a love of being outside and, you know, sharing in the beauty of what nature is giving us and trying to protect it. You know, like preserving our, we've got ancient apple trees and trying to preserve them and trying to get more bees back in the garden. And we've planted lots of wild garden and we've got some land beyond the house that we have put in more hedging, because if we don't look after the creatures, then what are we going to have left?
Mm.
Yeah. Certainly not us.
So it was originally a site of a castle here?
Yes, so there was a castle, it was taken down, and then another house was built on top of it, and then that was taken down in the 60s, and then my husband renovated what we have, and really, he's done everything. I just sit and nod and go, well, if you can see it, I'm going to trust you, because he has incredible vision.
And he does actually do a lot of practical work himself.
Yeah.
How he finds time to be a barrister and to lay bricks and design things. And all the design in the house and the garden
is him.
Extraordinary.
But it's him. He sees things like, we're very lucky we have a swimming pool, but we spent a year, and he's patient, which my children will think is hilarious when I say that. But he patiently made me work out over a year that putting the swimming pool in one place was not going to work, and this is where it should be, and he was right. It pains me to say that.
It's come on so much, because when I first came here, it was pretty much, there was pretty much nothing here.
No. There were some historic
beds. A few slabs.
Yeah.
And a funny sunken bit that looked quite outdated and overgrown and berberous and a few things like that. But now you've divided up the spaces, you've got this stunning parkland around it. And when you say the old oak died, so do you actually, when oaks are very ancient, they obviously start to have lots of rots and bracket fungi, which are all fantastically beneficial. So what a lot of people is just prune them heavily at the top, so they're less subject to wind rock and blow over.
Exactly.
So they carry on and regenerate almost from that lower
well,
down.
We've been really lucky. We have a really good team here. We have one guy who does everything to help with my husband, and then we have a couple of people who come in once a week, and one of them is a very keen arboretalist, really knows his trees.
Oh,
so
lovely.
We've done a lot of coppicing
and
pruning back, and we must have planted I think about 200 trees because we feel really profoundly that this isn't just about us, it's about
your children and their children and
so
subsequent
forth.
Children.
Yeah. I mean, I look at the trees that my parents planted. They planted some beautiful handkerchief trees in Northern Ireland, and I look at them now and I remember them going in.
Yeah.
And now I'm seeing my children under them and the magnolias, and and it's wonderful to see that, and preserving trees and caring for them because they carry so much history. I mean, we're really lucky we have a Judas tree.
Circis celestrum.
Absolutely. It's so beautiful. It's sitting immediately behind you and it's just coming to the end of its flowering. And Mark's been really brave in sectioning up the garden. And as I say, my job is to deal with people in crisis. And although that is what he does in practice for his work, he's got vision and sight and he can see things that I just can't.
But this is a lovely foil, foil, isn't it, to your other life?
Yeah, it is. This is my sanctuary.
Yeah. And it amazes me, this allergy, this phobia, this phobia you have with soil, because you really cannot cope with soil.
I can't bear putting my hands into, I will do it, but it genuinely makes me feel really sick. And I even struggle. Mark enjoys this, as do the children. If I see a freshly ploughed field and I can smell it, I actually will feel physically sick.
So has anyone tried to medically explain that? Because you're a child and I imagine you running around. I mean, yep. At what age would you not walk barefoot over some bare soil?
I don't remember ever wanting to do that.
Really?
Whereas my brothers, quite happily, but it just wasn't for me. And I'm not a clean freak. My husband will tell you I'm the biggest accumulator on the planet, but it's not that I don't recognise its necessity, and I'm fascinated by soil biomes. I want to get an anaerobic digester so that we can be nearly 100% renewable and recyclable. But I just can't bear the texture of it.
It's weird. Have you ever spoken to an expert on it and how you could get out of that? Because for me, who spends my life in
with
soil,
your hands
and
in
I
soil.
Love it. I love in, you know, you breathe it in, don't you, the soil microbes. You ingest them in many ways through your skin or whatever. And it's
absolutely
meant to be so healthy. And you can't. I wonder if there's something in you that is actually allergic to it, which has done this response.
I have no idea, but it's funny. I mean, I love pruning and tackling weeds, and I get a real buzz out of the tidiness of it.
But when you pull up a weed and the soil
on
I'm
wearing gauntlets. Listen.
Oh, right.
Yeah, I have gloves that go right under my armpits.
Really?
Absolutely. I mean, it's astounding. My mother-in-law thinks it is hilarious because she is brilliantly practical gardener. I mean, and I love it when she and my mother are together because they talk in Latin, basically, and plant types. I love it when my mother-in-law and mother are together because they're like a dynamic duo in gardening and they talk a different language and they just... I remember being pregnant with number four and Mark, it was one Christmas and Mark and I were sitting on the sofa in the kitchen and all of our children have floral names. We've got a rose, a violet,
forgotten all their names,
Heather.
So
I
many.
Know.
And so what was the third?
Heather. And number four has zinnia.
Oh, zinnia.
And I remember sitting on the sofa in the kitchen over Christmas and Mark and I reeling through names. And we were pretty suspicious it was another girl, having done three before. And I remember throwing out names and both of them just looking aghast at each other, going, absolutely not. And discussing like delphinium or poppy. Or
Hebe, lettuce.
Hebe, I would have loved.
Yes.
It's wonderful to have that unification, and I think people forget how much gardens draw people together.
Yeah.
You know, I think I remember being very profoundly moved about Horatio's gardens.
Yes.
And I know that a number of the cancer treatment units have recovery gardens.
Yeah.
And when I talk to friends of mine who are grieving, I find it's better to walk and talk.
Mm. Oh, definitely. No eye contact.
Yeah.
It's easier. You're more relaxed.
Yeah.
Yes.
And
yeah.
So for me, I see all of that. And one of our friends lost his brother. He's only 21 and he lost his 19-year-old brother in a car accident last year. Horrendously tragic. And when Tom and I talk, we just walk.
Mm.
And we walk around a garden or around grass or wherever, because you don't have to look someone in the eye. And there's something about knowing about the whole cycle of life in nature.
I think also it's just the fresh air. First thing in the morning, I'll often go out and you take a deep, even if you sleep with your window open, that deep hit of fresh air and the vision of the greenery around you, it really does you good, doesn't it?
Yeah.
I think. Yeah.
And it's funny when you talk about not wanting to put my feet in soil. I love nothing more than in the early morning. I'm a nocturnal, not a lark, but my husband is a lark. When I get up early and we go outside to walk the dogs, just standing with my bare feet on the grass with the morning dew in the summer.
Yeah.
There's something.
I think they've proven that does something, doesn't
it?
That
grounds
you and everything. Yeah,
yeah.
It's lovely. Really nice.
And you know, I look at something like Clarkson's Farm, which has been like our absolute family addiction, which is why we have Gerald the Jack Russell. You know, I look about them adding magnesium to the soil and bringing the soil back to life. My husband's obsessed with that.
Yeah.
He feels really profoundly about nurturing and caring
yeah.
for what we have.
Because we have done so much to destroy it
yeah.
in farming over the last, well, since yeah. the war, really, isn't
yeah.
it? Massively. And now we know with hindsight that a lot of what we've done has been so bad
yeah.
and really detrimental. But it's difficult to change it back, isn't it?
It is difficult to change it back, but I mean, we're fascinated by things like the Game Wildlife Conservancy Trust, which does brilliant things with beetle banks.
Mm.
And we went
in
up
your
to
garden. Do you yes, have beetle banks in your garden?
We do have beetle banks yeah. in the garden.
And for those who don't know, it's just little areas of rough grass where beetles can and procreate. And
absolutely.
And so that's a sort of natural type of a biological control for eating slugs and things like that.
Yeah, yeah. And we've done that. We've done miles of it
yeah.
here because we feel, and we've got a lot of hedging in because we could see there's a lot of open farming where we are. And what we did was put in hedging. So mm. we've probably put in a mile of hedging.
Mm.
And we've, sadly, our beekeeper has passed away. So a guy locally used to keep his bees here, and we're trying to find someone else who wants to do the same because the difference is extraordinary. When you see particularly on the fruiting of mm. the apple trees mm. And the plums.
Well, in Japan, they used to bring hives of bees. I'm sure they do into polytunnels and
yeah.
things like that and have them nearby. And I remember working when I worked for ADAS as a student, you know, the Agricultural Advisory Service, we used to put dead rabbits, would you believe, into strawberry tunnels to
yeah.
bring in the flies to pollinate
yeah.
the strawberries.
This is
People
amazing.
Think that was horrific now.
But blowflies are extraordinary.
Yeah.
I mean, entomology is one of the most fascinating subjects in the criminal world for me. And there was an amazing...
Oh, of course, eating corpses.
Absolutely, and there was an amazing guy at Cambridge called Professor Erin Kızıklı, who was mm. a Turkish, I believe, or Hungarian, forgive me. And he wrote this amazing book on how he was able to identify time of death from blowflies
mm.
and blowfly casing and larvae.
Yeah.
And we do that now.
Yeah.
And the Soan murder is another dreadful case close to here. That was solved by using forensic anthropology to understand when the leaves and the traces of the biomatter on the car tires and in the wheel arch, how you could link those back to a specific area.
Mm. Fascinating, isn't it? There's so much that seems to be uncovered recently in the microbiome, the soil biome, yeah. insect world that we
yeah.
have been totally unaware of. And I'm sure in 5 years' time, if we were sitting here, there'd be vast new areas
yeah.
explored and exploding.
Oh, I'm sure that's right.
Too. Yeah. It's interesting when you say, you know, your children deadheading the roses. I always, you know, those things are just one thing that Michael Mosley used to do so well. And one of them was being kind to people made you feel good. And I sometimes think that by growing and nurturing plants, it gives you, well, it certainly gives me that really nice feel inside me. Like when you say something nice to someone, I also think when you're nice to a plant, I
yeah.
think it has that same... It does make you feel good, doesn't it?
It does.
You're tending for something, whether it's a dog, a plant,
absolutely.
A child,
you're giving of yourself.
A friend. Yes.
And I profoundly believe by giving of yourself that, you know, I met Ron Dennis, Formula One man, in the most bizarrest of circumstances. I didn't actually know who he was, much to my husband's horror. And he's a really good man.
Yes.
He's a really, really good man. And he was helping people and he had... young people around and he was trying to give them opportunity. And I asked him why he did it. And he said, you have to pay it forward. And I thought that was such
you
a lovely expression.
You have to pay it forward.
What a brilliant, you mm. invest in it. You
yeah.
invest in your giving.
Yeah.
And you know, I look back, and just to bring back to what we were talking about, plants. When someone is sad, we send flowers. When someone is celebrating, we give flowers. My husband's done the loveliest thing. So for my 40th, he asked me what I wanted, and I said, I just like fresh flowers. So every week, I get fresh flowers. Sorry, every other week, fresh flowers. And that was 8 years ago.
Lovely. I noticed them inside.
Yeah.
Beautiful bouquet.
So every other Tuesday, I come in to find fresh flowers waiting
mm.
just for me.
Oh, how lovely.
And it's always different.
Mm.
And that's a really special thing.
Yeah. That is really lovely, isn't it? Really nice indeed. So the garden's really come on, and it is your hopefully you'll be here forever. You go
yep.
back to Ireland a lot, though.
I do.
You see
go
your
back
mother's gardens. And
yeah,
yes.
absolutely. I go back to Northern Ireland, is still where I grew up, but this is our home, and Mark and I've really
what we want is a home where everyone wants to come, where people feel safe and welcome. And it's about, you know, we spend so much time outside. Mm. I mean, with seven dogs, we don't really have a choice.
Gerald?
Yes. And the kids love mud. I mean, we're really lucky. We've got lovely farmers locally. Our 94-year-old next-door neighbour gave us two glorious fig trees, which he insisted on planting himself. And I suppose we live in a bit of the Garden of England, like the commercial Garden of England. And this is potato land, which I suppose is why the Irish girl found herself here. And we're so privileged. I look at the differences of the fen soils, and I look at the soil here, and I look, you know, then we go over to Cambridge and you look at the gardens and the botanic garden there. And it just makes me feel privileged to be able to see this and to claim a tiny part of it for my own.
And do you ever see trafficking around? Have you ever in the fens? I mean,
yeah,
it's all
absolutely.
Yeah.
We've got lots of lovely farmer friends, and one of them rang me and said, I'd want you to come over and tell me if this is what I think it is. And his wife speaks Russian fluently, and she was speaking to one of the workers, and she said she doesn't have her passport. She's not being paid what we're paying them, and the accommodation's dreadful. And so we asked a couple of questions, and we called the police in, and it was trafficking.
Gosh, so it's all around us.
It's all around us, and you know, I've been very privileged to prosecute some amazing cases. And as I said, I'm only the spokesperson. The hard work and the graft is done by my police officers and the CPS and my junior counsel who work with me. We've had victims who've been working quite, and I make it very clear, places like G's, who are really good companies doing really good things. But people who are not doing good things have placed those workers there.
So they're very clever how they infiltrate and get it.
Exactly, they infiltrate. In this case, there was a female, Yuliana Hadokovic, who worked in an employment agency and bypassed all their red markers and flags and placed these workers, victims, in jobs.
So it's a female.
Yeah, and actually that's a really interesting point you raise, Bunny. In modern slavery and human trafficking, in every case I've ever done, there has been a female protagonist as either the lead defendant or at the very top of the command chain.
Do you think that's because they're female, that the people that she's taking are often women, and so there's a better, they trust her more because she's a woman, and that's how it works?
I think that's part of it. In Operation Fort, we had three women, the mum of one of the main protagonist, was at the top of the chain, and she was the banker. We had Yuliana, who was placed in the employment agency. We had another woman, Natalia Zhmuda, also in an employment agency. In RVSK, the first modern slavery case, SK was Saida Khan. In the second case, it was also, it's an HIV specialist called Rebecca Balira, who was the perpetrator. In
why do I find this worrying? I do find it worrying because most criminals are male, aren't they?
Predominantly. Yes.
But in this business, it's the other way.
Yeah.
Why?
I don't know. And I think it's interesting you said in sex trafficking, yes, it's sometimes women who grew up, who start as sex workers and then, for whatever reason, become operators. In Operation Fort, we had 350 male victims and two female.
Gosh. I don't understand it at all. Do you think we'll ever see an end to it? I mean, it's...
No. The figures are 50 million around the world. And I think until we learn to buy better...
50 million!
Be better. I think until we want less for true value, and I can say that from my privileged position, that I can afford to buy less for more.
So so to really help us, what to really help this 50 million situation, what should we do in concrete terms?
In concrete terms, one, when you ask the question, how are you, of someone who you might not really normally interact with, your nail technician, the person who's washing your car, the person who's cleaning your offices, okay? When you say, how are you, actually wait for the answer. Don't say it as a platitude. Actually wait and see, how are they? In soup kitchens, how are you? Why are you here? Actually care and show compassion. Two, when you see it, call it out, report it. Okay? There's Modern Slavery Helpline. there is the police, and they're all being trained. Very many have been trained. And where you can afford to, buy better. Disposable fashion, fast food, you know, doing the right thing. We know what the right thing is. Mm. We do know what the right thing is.
Mm.
So strive to do it. But I'm privileged enough to be able to say I can afford to do that. I recognise that there are many who can't.
But you do buy secondhand clothes, maybe.
Yeah, I only buy secondhand clothes.
Likewise, me. I'm and I love it.
Yeah.
But, yeah, and you think that helps, obviously.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah.
I try and, or I buy ethically and sustainably. I'm very clued up on greenwashing.
Mm.
And actually, the law's changing. There's a directive handed down in Europe in April of this year, which means that every company in Europe with specific turnovers, and they're all graded, but every large company has to show at board level what they are proactively doing to ensure that they have better supply chains. By that we mean people properly paid, ethically working, etc.
Mm. But I mean, you do have to fill in these forms as a small company.
Yep.
To do this. But to be honest, those forms come through your approach to slavery in your business, and everybody just cut and paste. I think they're a bit of a waste of time, in my view,
yes,
because
I
you're not going to say I've got six slaves in the basement. Well, if you have, are you? So I do wonder about that sort of thing.
Okay, so I'll flip it this way. Do you remember Boohoo, clothing company?
Yeah.
Do you remember what happened to them during lockdown in Leicestershire?
I thought they went meteoric and then they collapsed.
And why did they collapse?
Was it slaves?
It's because one of the factors was because they were involved in the rag trade in Leicester, and people who were providing the clothing weren't paying their staff properly, and they were using illegal immigrants. Now, it wasn't Boohoo themselves, but it was who they were subcontracting to.
Yeah.
Reputational damage is massive. That was one factor taken into account.
Yeah.
And that's, it's those kinds of things. Who are you buying from and why? And although we can fill in the forms, the way I see the legal landscape changing, it's not enough to not proactively be bad. You have to proactively be good. And right. I think that's where the landscape's changing.
Right.
So you can't say, well, I didn't do anything wrong. What you have to be able to say is, what I'm doing right is.
Mm.
And you look at, so when we buy chocolate, and God knows we eat a lot of chocolate in this house, we eat Tony's because it's a company that I know has made extraordinarily big strides in trying to do what is right.
Mm.
And if I'm buying trainers and I have kids who do sport, I try to buy Adidas because I've looked at their supply chain and I'm happier with it than with some other trainer companies that make hockey Astros, for example.
Yeah. Interesting, fascinating.
But again, I emphasise I'm privileged enough to be able to afford to do that. And that, because I have that privilege, I need to use it wisely.
Yeah, no, that's a very good point. The other thing I forgot to mention about your garden, it is exceptional in the fact that you have a cricket pitch.
Yes, the love of Mark's life. I think it's safe to say it goes pitch, cutting equipment, dogs, children, and maybe me somewhere.
Oh, I think you're doing yourself down there. But I think that's fascinating because Capability Brown, and I feel this parkland around here feels very Capability Brown. And he often had a little cricket hut, didn't he?
Yes,
in
he
his
did.
Landscapes and the cricket pitch, because it is the sort of English country idyll, isn't it? In this lovely wood pastures landscape with these big old trees, little mounds, cricket pitch, cricket hut. It's just perfect, isn't it? I think that's so lovely.
Yeah.
Really nice. So can you give me a tip, your favourite gardening tip that you would do? I mean, I think your whole thing about, you obviously use it hugely.
Yes, we do.
To relax and enjoy
and
the outside space.
We spend a lot of time out here and we have friends around and we share. That's what we do, we share. We're big believers in sharing. I think my top gardening tip, my husband's going to die laughing when I say this, is deadheading roses as therapy.
Yeah.
I love it.
You and Mary Berry too.
I love my deadheading of roses. That's on Sunday afternoon. I spent an hour just pottering around, deadheading the roses, and I find it very comforting.
Yeah, it is hugely satisfying. And I think because when you do it, the rose looks 100 times better.
So much better
after you've done it, doesn't
it?
And the very fact that you're removing the spent flower, so it's not going to try and set
you're
seed.
Reviving it.
So you're reviving it. So you're stimulating to put in new growth, new buds,
yeah,
and they look much nicer. Yeah, I think that's a lovely tip. I enjoy doing it. I don't always do it as much as I should do. Because of time, but yeah. I love doing it when I do doing it. And do you do it with those little snips? Do you have those lovely little snips to do it with?
I do. A present for my mother-in-law. And I do it, and I sometimes put on a podcast and just potter around with the dogs and just snip. And we did it here last weekend, as I say. My husband was reading the papers, the children are splashing around. And I just pottered around and snipped away.
And what are these roses? You've got some lovely pink roses.
I think we've got some Gertrude Jekyll, which I absolutely love because the fragrance is just off the scale.
Yes.
And around my office, I think it is, I did want to
Claire
say...
Austin. Is yeah, it Claire, I think it's Austin? Claire Austin. It's a lovely white that you've trained up against the wall.
Yes.
She does climb nicely
she
against
does.
The wall.
And we also have some Lady Dixons. And my mother has given us a night rose. It's got a really interesting name. And it doesn't have huge numbers of petals. But it's very fragrant at night, and it's on my husband's office.
We're going to be frustrated there because we don't know what it is, but it's a single rose. When you
yes.
say it doesn't have many petals, so you see yes. this big boss of stamens.
Yes.
And what colour?
It's a very deep, deep blood red. It's beautiful.
Hmm. I wonder what that is.
My mother gave it to
and
me.
And does it flower all a lot from early to late?
It flowers from May
to summer.
Yeah.
Maybe it's Bengal Beauty.
It is Bengal Beauty. Well done, Bunny, you genius. It's a Bengal Beauty.
That is one of my favourite roses. I pinched a cutting from Nigel Slater's garden. He introduced me to it.
Oh, the man whose cookery books I eat for breakfast.
You'd love to hear that. And it is, sometimes it's called Bengal Tiger, and it's
yes.
a China rose.
Yes.
And so China roses are very old-fashioned, and they do like a warm... warm situation, but they grow in my garden fine.
Well, it's growing beautifully here, and it's still flowering, and it's a repeat.
Repeat goes on. It's one of the earliest.
And it's fantastic. I mean, I think ours came in really early this year, like mid-April.
Yeah.
And still giving.
And yeah. And mine will go until December.
Yeah.
And it's easy from cutting, so I've often given those away as
well,
presents to people.
Well, this is cut from Mummy's garden.
Yeah.
And, you know, we planted it 10 years ago.
Mm. When I first met you, you called her Mammy. Not Mummy.
I'm called Mama, and she's called Granny.
Yes.
Or she has an awful nickname that I can't repeat. But Granny is what the kids call her.
But you did call her Mammy, didn't you? Because that was the first time I'd heard that. And since then, I've heard lots of Irish films, and people call their mothers Mammy.
Well,
but that stuck in my head, or have I got that wrong?
Well, I think it was probably teasing her because I now can revert back to my Northern Irish accent. Apparently, when I get very cross, so my judges inform me, because they know when the temperature's boiling over in me because I suddenly become quite Northern Irish and sound a bit like Liam Neeson in Taken.
Love the Northern Irish accent. John Cushney, eat your heart out.
Oh,
I love
know.
It.
And, you know, it's funny. It's something that I revert to. And we all revert to taking... We're a family of taking the mickey out of each other.
I'm not surprised. Oh, wonderful. Well, I always like to bring my guest a present. And I've bought you, because when I first met you here, you had the most amazing boots on. They were multicoloured leather boots.
Yeah.
And I thought, wow.
Ridiculous.
And I even asked you the name, and I went back and looked up on the website when I got back. And then I thought, that's just too out there for me. They were really out there, and I actually capitulated, and so I didn't buy them.
Funny.
But I bought you a pair of boots, boots.
I know.
Now, my cleaner, lovely Diver, bought me these because her sister bought them for her, and they didn't quite fit. They are knockoffs, but as she assures me, they're really good.
Oh, they're really good.
Really good knockoffs.
They're really good.
And again, they're not quite right for me. I feel too out there in there. I haven't got your presence, your courage, your personality to wear these out there boots. So I thought they would suit you perfectly, or one of
Thank
your
you,
daughters.
Bunny, because you know, I mean, I am the Imelda Marcos of Cambridgeshire.
Yes.
It's just awful. My eldest daughter's nickname is Totty because she tottered around in my high heels.
God,
and
she had a choice to choose from,
did
she? Every day, a different one.
But the thing is, when I'm in court, we're in black.
Yeah.
And so when I'm not in court, well, today I look like I'm a stripe of Edinburgh Rock.
Yeah, lovely pink and white shirt.
But
die for.
But I don't, So being slightly quirky and different is my comfort zone.
I always remember working for Anne Malyneux, and yes. She famously had that court case because she used to claim that she never wore black in her private life. So yes. She wanted to claim her
the
clothes.
The black off her suits.
Which
right.
I thought was right, but she lost the case. But I think that is so mad. Would you redo that now? If you,
yeah, absolutely.
Because you would never wear black.
I would never wear black.
And can you put your black through your business?
No.
That's so wrong.
I know.
Your next mission.
Oh, there's so many missions. Mission Impossible. I mean, I don't wear black in my private life.
I can't ever see you in black. You're all multicoloured floral and everything.
Bright pink.
Yeah.
Fuchsia pink, turquoises.
Yeah.
Kind of reflection of the garden.
Yes.
I love my pinks and my whites and my lavenders. Yes,
yeah.
And we love our scents. I mean, we've got Jasmine Leonas going up. We've got an amazing...
What are Jasmine Leonas? I think that's an Irish interpretation.
Leonas. So
Jasmine Leonas.
Yeah, it's very scented and it's very hardy. So it flowers and it grows. It's the one that's growing over in between the fig tree. It's lovely.
I must go and have a look at that. Is it a Trachylospermum? Yeah. Jasminoides leone.
Yes.
Ah, right. Yeah. Lovely. And yes. Beautiful plants.
Lovely. And then we've got an amazing, Mark's planted some extraordinary clematis. I want to say clematis president or...
Yeah, could well be. Yes.
And they've been really giving
blue,
this year.
Aren't they?
Yes.
Yes.
And really punchy.
Yeah. Clematis have been amazing this year.
They really have. I mean, we've had a bit of a wet one, but it's not been too cold. We haven't that many.
No, very mild, very mild.
Which hasn't helped the bloody moths.
Yeah, but low light levels, low sunshine levels, so everything's a bit slow. But then they've gone on flowering and flowering.
I know,
which
and giving
love.
And giving.
Yes.
But my sadly was my peonies, which I absolutely adore, were over too quick because they came and then we had awful weather. But our irises, which we've planted... literally scattered them along the bank, and there's something really beautiful about their proudness, how they just emerge.
Yes. Yeah. And I like the fact they're quite ephemeral.
Yes.
Because you appreciate them all the more.
I know, there's something terribly... I kind of think of myself as a bit of an iris. Not retiring
enough.
I hope not. They pop their head up,
yes.
And you stand back and you look at them and go, oh, that might actually have been worth looking at. So I hope that I'm... saying something that might be worth listening to.
Oh,
that's how I think of them.
You definitely are. But thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
Oh, Bunny, the pleasure is all mine. And thank you for giving us the gift of this.
Pleasure.
You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books, and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.